Okay, thank you. As Peter said, one of the things I want to try and sort of get across is a little bit of perhaps of the history of where we come from. It's quite difficult in a sense because there isn't an awful lot of material around about the history. So some of it is me filling in blanks that I think should be filled in a way I think is appropriate. Others, you know, there's quite a collective knowledge of some of these experiences still around in DSTL. We'll probably correct me on some of them. But we went through a process of not necessarily keeping explicit what our history was. So a lot of these images that I'll show you as I go through this presentation are just what we've managed to save as we've gone through various iterations of transformation within DSTL, you know, from Ministry of Defence through to various forms of agency status and so on. And there's a lot of work that still needs to be done to recreate a proper story around that history. The title slide I've got here is that image is from what was called Divisional War Game, which I will talk about. And that's where I started back in 1985 as a young analyst in that Divisional War Game. And I just want to talk about a couple of little aspects that have come up in previous sessions as well. One of the things I want to reiterate is this idea about what you learn from doing the war games. When I first came into what was the MOD at that point in time, I sort of left school not very much. I became a clerical assistant for the Cooperative Society. I then in 1983 joined MOD as a clerical assistant there. I then saw a data processing job on what was called Divisional War Game at one of our war games departments. So I'll go up there. So I spent about 6 months trying to graph in minefields onto big maps and things like that ready for the war games. I then started to get involved in this a bit more seriously, doing lower controller activities and so on. By the time I'd finished working in Divisional War Game, I developed a really in-depth knowledge of Soviet tactics, regimental artillery groups, divisional artillery groups, signature things for recce, everything. And just the act of playing those things through really turns you into someone that can really start to debate and think these things through. And I think it's sort of stood me in good stead as I've gone through my career with wargaming. The other thing as well, just on the Divisional War Game front, is the adversarial side of things really took hold in the game staff that were there. So we had the traditional red-blue control room, and depending on who was running or who was actually the red or blue commanders at that point in time, you got different personalities coming to play. One red commander was very strong in that sense, used to get us to actually dress up in Russian Soviet uniforms at that point in time, marched us down to the blue rooms, and then we had to stand there and salute and say, Dzerazvicha, which was apparently some sort of challenge or welcome in Russian to the blue team. So he really wanted to get the adversarial juices going. And then at the end of the game, we used to celebrate with Russian food and vodka on site, which is quite good as well. There is one, if anyone knows of anything that can help me in one aspect of this, there was a Divisional War Game promotional video done at one point in time that I'm still trying to track down. So if anyone has any knowledge of that, I'd be extremely grateful. And it almost caused an incident on our site when we had serious people dressed up in Soviet uniforms for the video. No one had told security, so as they walked down to the canteen, it almost created a bit of an incident. So I'm going to go through a little bit of the history, but I want to try and pitch it within an analytical content as well, just so you get a rough idea of what we mean from an analytical perspective. So a little bit of a definition about sort of operational analysis, and two things highlighted there specifically. We see, obviously, we're doing war game within the context of trying to apply operational analysis. So really what we're talking about here is trying to think about the application of scientific techniques, yeah, to try to support evidence-based decision making. Now, you've heard a number of things today that gives you hopefully a flavour that operational analysis is a multidisciplinary subject. There's all sorts of techniques that are brought to bear, whether it's manual gaming, computer gaming, so on, seminar gaming, whatever. There's a whole range of sort of backgrounds and disciplines. So myself, computer scientists, then psychologists, we've heard social scientists, we've got physicists, chemists. They're all bringing different experiences, different things together when we're doing that. The evidence-based decision-making thing is becoming increasingly important, and particularly recently, not all of you will be aware, but there were some issues with recently letting railway contracts within the UK. So, you know, McPherson reports come up about what's the nature of evidence, what's the nature of challenge within assumptions that are made, sensitivities to thing as well. So evidence-based decision making is suddenly sort of becoming more and more important as a concept to understand what do we mean by evidence for a start, how do we define that? And really trying to look at this idea of sort of making sure we remove any hint of advocacy and we look at objective evidence-based assessment as well. As I say, there are a range of techniques that are used to do that. One of the things that has been increasingly useful at the moment within the army context is the Army's very much trying to embrace this whole notion of thinking about evidence-based decision-making and analysis and experimentation. And this comes together in this form of this handbook that was released early in this year, which is trying to bring together a whole range of sort of best practice ideas around how might you go about conducting some form of analysis, what does it mean to be objective, what does it mean to conduct an experiment. So there's a whole range of different definitions and various aspects of guidance in there to sort of start taking the analyst and the end user through the idea about what it means to actually conduct operational analysis from a perhaps a scientific perspective. Focuses an awful lot on experimentation, but I thought I would just talk about it here, and I think obviously we've had a flavour of some of this over the last day or so, anyway. An experiment to sell, so it's not actually the exercise or the model or anything like that. So what we're trying to do is understand the problem that we've got, break that down into such a way that we can start to articulate some useful hypothesis about something. So we may be doing, if possible, some sort of causal effect type analysis. We may just be looking for some sort of correlational study or something like that. But there's a whole range of techniques that we're bringing together to try to provide some sort of guidance and some sort of idea as to how we might go ahead and provide some sort of objective evidence as well. It's all done within this control process, but to make that process available to analysis and critique and everything else, we need to think about how we actually expose aspects of that process. So I'm going to touch on this idea I've got at the moment that's based on the application of rigour, but I just want to leave that as an idea in mind, as a mnemonic to go away with, that I'll go through to hopefully give you a flavour of how I'm thinking about trying to approach some of the analysis we do, and then when we're applying wargaming in particular, how I can get analysts to think about this idea of rigour. I want them to think about it as well, because as an analyst, I've got a professional ethical duty to make sure that I apply things in the most appropriate way, and that's one of the things I just want to touch on next. So operational analysis rigour, what does that actually mean? So I've borrowed something from a colleague of mine, the reference is in the presentation notes. There's this idea of following a rigorous process. So if I'm going to be constructing a war game activity and I want to undertake an ethical analytical activity, because I have to think about who the end users are, what the advice is going to be used for, and Graham mentioned yesterday in his thing about wargaming saving lives as well, I have an ethical duty and responsibility as a professional analyst to make sure that I do things in the best possible way I possibly can. So I'm trying to introduce this idea, particularly given the fact this land experimentation analysis handbook is out there now. The end user is very much aware of the right sort of questions to be asking now and challenging the analyst and providing that challenge to the advice that's coming out. So if I'm going to do a war game, what does rigour mean? So if I want to think about repeatability here, how might I think about ensuring that I record all the right sorts of things to enable another analyst to perhaps have a go at reproducing that war game event? So if I recorded the sorts of schemes of manoeuvre that might take place, if I got all the material constrained in such a way that we understand all the limitations and assumptions around something as well, have I described the method, the rules, are they all available for people to be able to reuse, and so on. And then I want to think about this idea of independence. So have I actually inadvertently introduced any sort of bias, particularly perhaps into the question that may be posed? Have I introduced any sort of bias if I'm forming up some sort of hypothesis I might want to test and think about? Are the rules biased in any particular way that might slant an output to a certain type of outcome as well? Is the data independent? Have I managed to source data from the most credible source I possibly can? Is that an important thing for the study question at hand as well? So it's just starting to get people to think around some of these things in terms of designing the whole thing. When it comes down to thinking about grounding reality, some of this was spoke about a little bit yesterday in the session did on verification validation. Very much about this fitness for purpose. Does it pass the do I believe it test when you get some of the outputs out? We often get some aspects of the games, and particularly on the computer side of things, where you can get certain outcomes that you can't easily adjust for because you're not doing it manually. And it's how do you work in those sorts of things to say, it may not have happened the way you like it, but can we work with this and reinterpret that in a way that makes it useful for you as well? So there's an awful lot of thinking about, how do we make sure that what comes out is credible in the mind of that that user as well. Objectivity of process. So we may have the rules, particularly important or difficult when you've got computer-based simulations. How do we expose the logic behind that? how do we make that visible and available to people that want to understand, well, why does that thing work like that? I don't quite understand that interaction there. So how do I make it clear exactly what's happening? Some of that may come down with the way I have to think about the analysis and the presentation of the information that's been produced by the war game. So can I trace through cause and effect in some way? So if I can see, well, there was actually some sort of acquisition that took place over here, here's the causal chain that I can trace through in the analysis that shows that that effect that was delivered by the artillery system caused that, was a result of that acquisition, for example. So making that clear and available to everyone. Uncertainty in data as well. I've had some discussions with people in the sidelines as well, to a certain extent, about what are the key drivers in terms of some of the insights we get out. So we had the issue come up in verification about sort of the replication side of things and how many samples of something you may have to do to understand whether you've got something that, you know, is a good, credible outcome. Well, how do we understand whether or not that thing would have changed as a result of a change in certain piece of input data, or a certain way in which the game rule may have been framed up, for example, as well. I then started to think this idea about robustness of results. If I've got an insight or an outcome from one particular game, one scenario, does that translate across to another scenario? So then I'm starting to build up this idea of, you know, how can I evaluate the evidence or the output from a particular war game, thinking about this idea of rigour as well. And hopefully making sure that as an analyst, thinking that through on a day-to-day basis as I'm doing my studies starts to sort of make sure I can be relatively happy that I'm putting in place some sort of evidence-based decision-making process there as well. So think about rigour. How do I apply that to all the sorts of questions we may get asked? I mean, we've had a flavour of them from Paul's presentation this morning, but there's a whole range of different things we may get asked. So command and control, for example, how do working in sort of the complex endeavours we operate in now affect command and control arrangements? You know, are there different ways in which we can form up? Are there different ways in which we can pass information around, for example? What are the implications for army reforms and force structures? So, you know, reduction in the amount of infantry in the British Army, what does that mean for the sorts of operations we can do? Where does that expose risk, for example? How do rules of engagement affect operational outcome? A whole range of different sort of questions and problems we're posed. Now, the sorts of issues that we get presented with don't always appear as particularly useful research questions. So part of that rigour process and that whole dynamic you have to go through is re-articulating or working with the customer and the end users to actually frame a question that is suitable for analysis as well. And interestingly enough, sort of looking at some of the earlier reports from some of the initial games that come out, many of those sorts of problems they were facing back in the 50s and 60s that I'll touch on in a moment are still evident today in the sorts of questions that are being posed. So working with sort of people to understand the questions and whether or not you've actually articulated and answered the questions quite clear as well. Okay, so where do we come from? So I mentioned a little bit about operational analysis. Many of you may or may not know operational analysis, also equivalent to operational research. We decided to change really as an extent of having operational requirements branches and just try to differentiate between the two. Very much started as a discipline around about the start of the Second World War, during the Second World War, and many of you will be familiar with the sorts of, you know, applications of operational analysis in the past, looking at the effects of convoys, how do you look at mitigating the effects from U-boat attacks and so on and so on. There are other things that have gone in terms of looking at air defence systems. The Army's operational research groups in terms of operational analysis were stood up around about the time during the war. They formed part of the operations that went through Normandy, providing advice on artillery effectiveness, direct fire effectiveness, all sorts of things like that. And I guess what started to emerge out of this was the idea post-war that there was some utility in the application of what they termed their scientific techniques and principles to understand operational issues. So 1959, and I say this is very much where history gets a little bit patchy, because the only thing I really know about what was going on back then is from one photograph on a wall and one report that I managed to find in 1962 that talks about the game that was conducted then. There was a game called the Army Operational Research Group game. It was core level, went down to company icons, and was played on a map of 150 by 90 kilometres. We're now doing those sorts of map things, typically with a battle group plus. So then you had a core all condensed into that sort of terrain there. It was turn-based game, so I think they ran a number of turns over a period of a few days and weeks. But obviously what they were looking to try and do was sort of understand, you know, post-war game issues, so starting to get into Cold War sorts of areas here as well. So very much things like terrain were fixed and so on. But the report that was looking at the war, developing wargaming capability, that 1962 report, was very much talking about computers are on the up here. How are we going to start using computers? And they're already starting to explore some ways in which they could bring computer technology in to support the application of wargaming. So that's the closest I can get to what I think may be of reporting the 1962 report and the 1959 game. So this is that Army Operation Research Group game, we think. Obviously, fixed terrain, yeah, with all sorts of undulations in to help with line of sight. I guess to a certain extent, people were familiar with the terrain because that was where we expected to be fighting over, so they had some intimate knowledge of what that terrain was like as well that would have informed things. And traditionally set around the Kriegsspiel, so red-blue control as well. I gather, reading the report as well, that they had a 100-page rule book, so I guess it took quite a bit of time to go through various turns and everything else, and I guess you could start to understand some of the drivers for how they may be thinking about introducing some sort of computer technology as well. So does that help with line of sight statistics and so on? So the early 1960s, we start to see still very much obviously manual gaming, turn-based, but we start to see computer assistance start to emerge. And you can see some of the latest technology dotted around the edges there, as it was then. And I guess those sorts of things there were really starting to, obviously you've gone to a 2D flat map now, so they're really starting to help with doing line of sight statistics as well, which used to take quite a bit of time to actually crunch through. Some of those computers around there would have started to provide assistance with recording the outcomes of some of the activities as well. There may be some arbitration that was taking place using some of the computer assistance as well. I guess as well, much like it is today, a lot of the drivers would have been around reducing staff sizes and the cost of conducting war games at that point in time as well. But we're very much starting to see the introduction of computer assistance within that as well. As we get into the 80s, we're very much in the Cold War era here, and to a certain extent, this is my personal view of what was going on at Fort Halstead at that point in time. This is probably the golden age of wargaming. I think we had a divisional war game that was taking place there and a battle group war game that was taking place. Adversarial again, in the sense that, you know, the divisional war game was always better than the battle group war game, and they were better than us. But there was an awful lot of gaming took place. So the divisional war game, we used to run 6 war games a year. They used to last a month each game. We used to have 30 to 40 players coming in and play that. A big, big event. And we used to play, probably if we were lucky, we'd play about 30 minutes a day. But by then, because it was computer-based, yeah, it wasn't turn-based. We'd really moved into the realm now of what we call discrete event simulation. Yeah. So it was more dynamic in that sense. You had to respond pretty quickly to what was going on because you wasn't given the opportunity to think about what you want to do in your next turn. It was happening almost, not quite real-time, but yeah, there was enough going on real time to keep you very busy and to keep you worried about what the enemy were doing. So you've very much got that sort of that interaction and that sort of challenge thing coming in as well. One of the things that obviously this started to do was increase the sort of capability to start to understand little bits of causal chain, cause and effect. So the introduction of the discrete event simulation started to give us the means by which we could trace through the actions. And what you started to see with the computer support at that point in time is the introduction of database systems and all sorts of things like that that would start to give us what we call post-game analysis. So we've started to construct quite large databases of what happened, how many shots were fired, who shot at who killed who, and then you're starting to then extract out of that various statistics from the hundreds, say, direct fire battles that may have taken place, what can you infer about the effect of different types of weapon system. So you start to see the emergence of those sorts of capabilities. And then we get into fully computerised, and obviously there have been discussions here about the emergence in the map and things like that. So this is very much the Battle Group War Game activity. This is the Janus, early version of Janus, that came across from the US, and we turned it into a UK version with UK doctrine and TTPs as well. But very much immersed in the screen, and very, very little map interaction. We're starting to go back a little bit, obviously now having bird tables to help with setting some of that orientation, which is important as well. And what we found with not only the Battle Group War Game, but the Divisional War Game, is that we needed this idea as well of having what we called satellite simulations around some of these things. So you do an execution of the war game, and then that execution of the war game in terms of the movements, the schemes of manoeuvre, were then input into a number of satellite simulations. So the Battle Group War Game had its own fully immersive constructive simulation that would take output from that, and then you can do a whole series of what-if iterations around that. The Divisional War Game had its equivalent operational level simulation that would take the output from that and run its whole series of what-if activities around that. The problem with those things were they were different levels of abstraction, different rule sets, different equations, and so on. So what we tended to find as time's progressed on, and we now get into the noughties as such, we've moved into two key areas where we've got war game in the top left there, which is very much based on Khan, or which is Khan, sorry, bottom left there, which is our WISE war game that we're currently running. They're very much, they're not just war games, but they've got the ability to go to constructive simulation mode using exactly the same software. Yeah? So you're removing one level of uncertainty in the sense of, oh, I've got different algorithms for indirect fire in that war game as I've got in that simulation. They're exactly the same things. So we're starting to remove some levels of uncertainty in terms of us being able to conduct the what ifs. So we've very much got integrated war gaming and computer-based activities. Still very much based around screen, but what you don't see in the pictures in the bottom right-hand side there is that we also lay out big map tables as well. So it's a way of making sure that the players don't get immersed into their own screens and fight as individuals. Having the map on the table enables them to come out and actually fight as a command team as well. But we're very much now into the ideas of perception-based modelling, command and control issues become important now, moving away from more the physics, getting into some of the more difficult intangible areas as well. Thinking about this sine wave of wargaming again that's been discussed, I guess because we're moving into these more difficult areas of analysis, so we've very much done all the physics sorts of things, understand those pretty well and how we might model those, we're now into these areas that are really quite difficult to understand. So I guess what we've seen now is the re-emergence of manual techniques, particularly in the area I'm working in now, as becoming more and more important to start to understand some of these problems. As Paul was saying, you can change the rules where it is, you can do quick adjustments on things as well. So this is very much, I think, the area of resurgence that we've had recently, I would say, is more on the manual side of things, which is a good thing as well. Where next? I put technology up there because I don't think it's relevant, really, but it's just there's an attraction of where next is technology related. So is it all touch screens? Is it virtual reality? Things like that. For me, I think the big thing that I want to sort of think about taking away, for me, the big thing is the investment in the analyst as well and the people that are involved in the game. And it's not necessarily being seduced by the next bit of technology that may come along, but we need to make sure that thinking about that analytical approach, professional analyst, the rigour, make sure the analyst has all the relevant tools to actually design the games well, to get the right outcomes, to get the people that are working in those games to go away with the right sorts of insights in that as well. So where next? How do we think about developing the analyst? How do we develop the ability to sort of get an insight from a game to become a lesson in someone's mind? Where we cross that boundary, I don't know. How do we get the senior people involved is the big thing for me. And it's important because the advice matters. The thing on the left-hand side there, very, very simple game that was done. I wasn't involved in that. I don't know whether maybe someone here that's gone there that may have been involved in that. But we did Lego Granby. So this was looking at breaching the berms in First Gulf War. Very, very simple game that was done. In the middle there, we did a very, very early version of WISE looking at UK-US joint fires. So we had two groups come together. The game itself at that point in time was actually relatively immature. There's all sorts of bits of sticking plaster holding things together everywhere, but we still made it work, and they got some really good insights out. And obviously Paul's mentioned the work with Possum and ISAC, so I won't dwell on that. And finally, I just want to, I mean, I think we've probably all thought about this as well. Although I've mentioned that we've got the computerised war gaming, they're very good at getting results out, as we say, in terms of sort of, you know, numbers of kills of this, killer victim tables and so on. It's very much about the understanding as well. So when we're doing a computer-based wargaming, it's very much using it as a facilitation tool. So if you come into any of the rooms we're running as, we'll have big sheets of A4 paper up everywhere. We're asking people to put all sorts of post-its up about issues. They're all taken for, used in plenaries. And someone mentioned this morning, I think, about exposing people's thoughts to everyone else. So all these post-its are up. You can question things, you can test things out. So it's all very much about not trying to get too engrossed in the war game as the actual thing itself, but getting that understanding out and making sure people go away with that understanding. That's it. I'll leave you with that.
Oh, thank you for that. That was
fantastic. Check how long I've got.